Kick-Ass Dice, sharing tips to help empower you to take control of your career. Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. This is Anne from Kick-Ass Vets. This is episode 29 of our podcast, Medical Biases, and how Kick-Ass Vets combat these medical biases. This is going to be a bit of a longer one just to prepare you. We are going to talk about the 10 most common medical biases that lead to mistakes in our profession. And then we're also going to talk about 10 ways that we can combat these medical biases on a day-to-day basis. First of all, I'm just going to quickly talk about what medical biases are and why they're important. When we talk about medicine, we talk about cognitive errors. Cognitive errors are errors in our thought processes or ways of thinking. So if we look at the stats and the numbers in human medicine, anywhere from 15 to 30% of cases are misdiagnosed. And due to limitations in vet med, we can assume that our misdiagnosis rate is higher than that. In human medicine, 80% of misdiagnoses are due to cognitive errors, and half of those lead to harm to the patient. So in vet med, that means if you look at the math, at least 12% of our patients are suffering from errors in our thinking processes. That's a scary number. More than 1 in 10 of our patients are suffering because of how we think inappropriately. And if we can just address these biases and actively work to limit their effect, we can drastically improve patient care. So this topic is going to be spread over 3 different blogs, and I'm also going to have a webinar presentation for you, but I am going to do it all in one podcast so that you don't need to, you know, go to different parts. So we're going to jump right in and we're going to talk about the 10 most common medical biases that we see in veterinary medicine. The first bias I want to talk about is something called an anchoring or diagnosis momentum bias. And this happens when you continue on a current treatment plan despite a lack of clinical improvement, or if you ignore or inappropriately assess new information because it doesn't fit with your initial diagnosis. This happens more frequently when the person that made the initial diagnosis you perceive as senior to you. So whether that's a colleague that you think is smarter or more experienced, whether that's coming back from a referral center, from the specialist or the GP, or whether it's your boss that diagnosed it, we're less likely to question authority, essentially. So we're less likely to question someone that we perceive knows more than us when they've made the diagnosis. An example of this that I personally experienced was I had a dog come in for a prolonged clotting time and being pale, diagnosed as rat bait toxicity from the regular vet. I said, yes, that all makes sense. Put it in a kennel, checked it a couple hours later. And at that point it had neurologic signs, which did it have mild neurosigns when I first saw it? I don't know. I didn't properly fully assess it because I just said, okay, this guy's already got a diagnosis. It was a busy night. So I just carried on with that. That dog unfortunately ended up dying despite getting multiple vials of antivenom because it ended up being a snake. And if I hadn't had this anchoring and diagnosis momentum bias when I first assessed the case, maybe I would have noticed that its pupils were dilated and not constricting. Maybe I would have noticed decreased palpebral. I don't know if those signs were there because I didn't do a full assessment because I had this anchoring and diagnosis momentum bias and that dog died because of my care. Would it have died anyways? Who knows? But if I'd gotten snake venom into that dog right away, would it have made a big outcome difference for that dog? I think it probably would have. So how do we combat this bias? Because this is one that is really, really commonly seen, especially in veterinary medicine. One of the biggest ways is to reassess each case with each new shift or each day. So no matter what comes through your doors, no matter who has diagnosed it, reassessing all of that information and making sure that something hasn't been missed. You know, we all screw up. We all miss things. The specialists miss things. It's really important to reassess. And especially in a 24-hour center, one of the great things about having multiple vets taking over is every 12 hours or every 8 hours or 10 hours, you have a new vet on the case, which means there's more brains. So reassessing every time is really important. Also, never ignore information. So if you have a diagnosis and then you do a test and that just doesn't fit, don't just think, oh, that test must be faulty or, oh, that's weird. You need to prove to yourself that a test wasn't flawed before you assume it's flawed, and or you need to find a reason. And if that doesn't fit with your diagnosis, you need to consider this might be a different diagnosis. Also, another really good thing is reassessing each, especially if a case is just not quite right. Reassess the case from the beginning, assuming that your initial diagnosis is wrong, therefore forcing your brain to consider alternatives for all of the information that you're being provided. The next bias we're going to talk about is something called ascertainment bias. And this is when you base a clinical decision based on what you expect of a clinical sign instead of what you're truly finding. So we will commonly see this in terms of breed biases. We do it all the time. So if you think of the schnauzer with a sore belly and an elevated amylase, we're going to say, oh, that has pancreatitis, and more likely treat it medically and not pursue an x-ray. And it turns out, you know, maybe it has an abdominal tumor, maybe it has a foreign body because it ate something. So, you know, it's missing a diagnosis because you're basing it on a breed, or you have the 12-year-old German Shepherd with a hemoabdomen and you assume it's a bleeding tumor instead of potentially rat bait. So this is something that we very commonly do. We stereotype based on breed. We stereotype based on clientele. And that is a really dangerous thing to do. So how do we combat this bias? Make sure you're ruling out your differentials. Every single case should have a problem list made and a differential list made, and you need to make sure you're accurately ruling out those other differentials. You also want to make sure you're gathering enough data to confirm your diagnosis. And a lot of times in vet med, that's hard to do because we have financial limitations from our clients, we have time pressures from our clients, we have time pressures from our boss, and we have huge imposter syndrome where we think that we should know all the answers without diagnoses. Well, realistically, we need to do the tests. You can't know what the answer is of the test before you do the test. And we need to just accept that the tests are there for a reason. And as medicine progresses and we have more technology, we're going to need those tests even more. So making sure that we're getting enough information to confirm a diagnosis instead of just making an assumption is really important. And lastly, you know, as I mentioned, making a problem list and a differential list for every single case is really important. The next big bias we're going to chat about is availability bias. And this is when you favor an easily concluded diagnosis. So basically, you favor the diagnosis that comes to mind the most easily. So whether you recently missed a diagnosis in a case, so for example, after I missed that snake bite case, I did a lot more snake venom detection kits after that because I was worried I was going to miss it, and I was looking for those signs in all of these weird presentations because I felt bad for missing it the previous time, and that was my availability bias of doing that test. Or if the other thing that can happen is if you've had a run of a few diagnoses in a row, then you're going to assume that the next one is that diagnosis as well. With the fires that we've been having in Australia recently, there's been a lot more cases of respiratory distress that haven't been necessarily heart disease or PTEs. And therefore, it's easier to assume that, okay, maybe this is just a bit of breathing up from pneumonitis or asthma versus these other diseases. It can also happen when you have an increased perception of the prevalence of a disease. So, for example, if you have a certain interest in an area, then you may perceive that the prevalence of that disease is more common just because it's more on the top of your brain and you're more likely to pick that. So it's basically favoring the diagnosis that most easily or first comes to mind instead of thinking hard about other diagnoses. Basically, humans are lazy and we're going to pick the thing that most easily comes to mind. So the biggest way to combat this bias is being aware that this bias exists. And some of us are more susceptible to certain biases versus others. And if this is something that you are susceptible to, recognizing that and then realizing that for every case you need to slow down instead of jumping to conclusions and jumping to a diagnosis, just slow down and assess, can this be something else, is going to be really helpful. The fourth bias that we're going to talk about is kind of a double whammy. It's the commission or omission bias, and this is an individual's tendency to either act, which is a commission bias, or not act, which is an omission bias. So some doctors and some people are the wait and see type, and others are the test for everything right now type. My personal bias is a commission bias. I have no patience at all, and I want to do every test under the sun immediately. So I have to constantly remind myself when I want to do all of these tests, is this because I'm curious and I want to know, or is that because that's what's best for the animal? Versus omission bias, where if you're a wait and see type, you have to actively think, okay, should I be more aggressive with this case, or am I just waiting because I don't want to do that next step? So, you know, the most common thing and common manifestation of this bias that we see is GP versus eMERGE. eMERGE doctors, because they see the cases that have gone badly with the wait and see, because they have more liability legally because they don't have the relationship with clients, you know, and I think just as a nature, the people that tend to go into emergency medicine tend to have less patients, are more likely to have a commission bias, where GPs tend to have more of an omission bias because they have their experience and personalities are more of that type. So, you know, the biggest example of that is the vomiting dog. The commission bias wants to do x-rays right away, and if there's something questionable, go to exploratory surgery, where omission bias, you know, may just do a wait and see or may try meropitant, and then if it's not better, then do an x-ray. Obviously, both of these have pros and cons, and hindsight's 20/20 on which one was right. So knowing what your, in terms of combating this bias, knowing what your own tendency is and actively working against that tendency is going to be the way to combat that. The fifth bias that we're going to talk about is the confirmation bias or wishful thinking bias. And what this is interpreting and considering information to either fit a preconceived or desired diagnosis. So if this is in your own patient, or if this isn't a patient that you really love, you don't want it to have cancer, so you ignore the lump and say, oh, it's probably nothing. Or you read the high lymphocyte count as, oh, a little, you know, red herring or something like that, instead of thinking, oh, maybe it has lymphoma and looking into it. Another example would be if you have dysuria in a dog, and if you find hematuria for a dog that presents for straining to pee, and you find some blood in it, you say, oh yes, this is a UTI, instead of using that as a piece of a puzzle, because blood in the pee does not itself indicate a UTI. It's one piece of the puzzle. So you would need to do culture and imaging to rule out tumors, to rule out polyps, to rule out stones. So it's not just assuming or wanting a disease to be something and then taking the information to fit what you want it to be or what you thought it might be, and actually proving to yourself that your diagnosis is in fact accurate and true. And how do we combat this bias? You know, slow down, just don't jump to conclusions. When we try to jump to an answer right away, this often happens. Create problem lists and differentials for every single case, and interpret and consider all information. Don't ignore information that doesn't fit with your previous information and your tests. And also, don't overinterpret a single test. Don't take that bloody urine as, yes, this is an answer for a UTI, because it's not. It just means that there's blood in the pee. It doesn't mean that there's bacteria. It doesn't mean that there's a UTI. The next bias that we're going to chat about is an outcome bias. This is our, essentially, hindsight is 20/20 bias. So this is talking about how we interpret or interact with colleagues when we have a case referred to us, or, you know, if we're judging a case. So basically, when you are reevaluating a case, or if you for some reason, you know, if you're on a board, disciplinary board, you need to be assessing the case with the information that that individual had at that time. And that might be, and the resources that that doctor had at that time. So, you know, it might be that they recommended tests, but the owners declined until the animal got sicker, or it might be that they didn't want to pursue the other tests at that point. You need to evaluate people's decisions and courses of action based on the information that they had at that time and not interpret it based on hindsight. And this we see a lot in veterinary medicine. You know, unfortunately, vets are really, really terrible to one another. We judge each other. We attack each other for what we felt would have been the best course of action. And, you know, we listen to clients and believe them when they say their vet said this or that, when we all know how often clients just blatantly lie. So it's really important that we're being supportive of one another and not making decisions based on what we think they had and make decisions based on what we know they had. And this is really, I think, really, really important for the mental health aspect of our profession. So how do we combat this bias? Always assess any case in past history based on the information and resources available at that time, and never, ever assume you know what conversations were had with owners or what the patient looked like at that point. How do you do that? And how do you make sure that other people are judging your cases and everything appropriately? Great records. It's very important for you to have very detailed records that document what was offered, what wasn't offered, the owner's wishes, what the animal looked like, what tests were done, what weren't done, and why. Not only is that going to help the medical progression of the case, because then you know what they looked like at what point, but also it's going to help protect you in terms of litigation, and it's going to help protect you when you're sending your case to someone else, because they're going to say, oh, look, they offered this and this. And, you know, not that we should necessarily have to do that in terms of not judging each other in the profession, but it really helps that scenario. The next bias we're going to chat about, this is number 7. I know this is long. Thanks for staying with me so far, is premature closure or search satisfaction bias. And this is most commonly seen in radiology or imaging. And this happens when you stop looking for another diagnosis when you found your quote unquote answer. So, you know, I messed this up one time where I saw a dog that was a cavy and it was sore walking and would yelp intermittently, but not always. So the owners brought it in. I examined the dog. I was busy, didn't do as detailed of a physical exam as I should have, obviously, and took some x-rays of the belly because it seemed like it was sore and yelping in the belly area, and I found a big chunk of bone in the stomach. Talked to them about all of the different, you know, risks of making a vomit versus not, and thought, you know, maybe the bone poking the stomach could be causing pain. How often do we see that? Rarely ever, but I put that into my mind as a wishful thinking bias as well, because I wanted that animal to be sick for that reason, because I wanted to have found the answer. Also, I displayed confirmation bias, which is when you take the information to suit what you expected to find. So I displayed 3 different biases in this one. I made the dog vomit. The bone came up. Everyone was super happy, sent the dog home, and the dog returned later, still painful. And it was actually the nurse that was doing the triage that found the lump in the inguinal region and pointed that out to the other vet colleague, because I had gone home at that point and diagnosed an inguinal hernia. So because I took x-rays, saw the big, giant, bright, shining bone, I didn't even notice the hernia that was on that x-ray. So I completely missed that. Fortunately, aside from a few hours of discomfort, that dog had no ongoing issues. It didn't have strangulated bowel, but really that could have gone in a really bad direction. So for me, that was, I displayed multiple biases on that case, and it's really easy to do if you see something. So how do we combat this bias? slow down, having a systematic approach that is consistent for every case. So for your physical exams, when you're interpreting blood work, when you're interpreting any type of imaging, having a systematic approach that you do every single time so that it can't be missed is really important. So if that means that you have templates in your records, so when you do an abdominal x-ray, it lists everything that you have to comment on, that's helpful because then it forces you to go back, check the x-ray for those things. The next bias we're going to chat about, number 8, is sunken costs bias. This is something that we really feel in veterinary medicine because of the owners having to pay out of pocket for all of the tests and interventions that we do. So basically, this is a bias where we're reluctant to let go of a particular diagnosis for a different diagnosis due to time or money or emotion invested into that diagnosis. Our egos get hurt. Financially, it plays into a role because we feel bad and we have guilt because we feel bad that the owners have paid money for a diagnosis and possibly part of a treatment plan that wasn't the underlying problem. So, you know, perfect example of this, which I've seen more than once, is Dachshund presents for ataxia. They have an MRI to look where the disc is. And then as they're recovering or something like that, the nurse finds the tick and it's a tick paralysis. So it's a common thing. We do see it very often and it's, you know, you don't want to then go to the owner and say, this is a tick and we did this MRI that cost $4,000. It's hard. It's hard to do. The big thing that we need to recognize is that multiple diseases can look the same. So really making a problem list and making a differential list and going through your differential list is really important. The other big thing that we need to remember is we can't have an ego and we also can't have guilt for doing a test that makes clinical sense and might end up being a negative result. Negative results in themselves are useful pieces of information and tests exist for a reason. So yes, if we found the tick beforehand, then that would be great, but it's very easy to miss ticks as well. That's why we shave them. So it's understanding and removing the guilt of, yes, we did the wrong test, because that's going to happen. That is part of medicine. Slowing down and having systematic approaches, of course, helps you decrease the chance of missing things. And explaining the value of negative tests to owners is really helpful in combating that financial aspect. All right, number 9, this is a triage bias. And this one just talks about the fact that how an animal is triaged, either by owners or your reception or your nursing team, or even another doctor, will affect our perception of the case. So how severe a case is addressed is going to be affected by how someone else assessed the severity beforehand. So, you know, you've all been there. You have these cases where someone comes in carrying their animal, runs in, they're like, my dog's in pain. It's in so much pain. It can't walk. And you think, oh shoot, like this is really serious. You give it a shot of methadone or hydromorphone or whatever you have right away because you think the dog has to be incredibly painful. And then you set it down and it's got a bit of a limp. You have other clients that come in and the dog's walking in and it's got a leg dragging, essentially unable to move. And the client patiently sits and waits for their turn, and how that client comes in and how severely they present themselves affects A, how quickly they're seen, which is unhelpful. It also affects how quickly we jump to giving pain medication. It also is going to affect how aggressive we are in terms of diagnostics. Obviously, if the leg is hanging, we're probably going to do some x-rays, but for that limping dog, we might be way more aggressive about pursuing x-rays because that client's perception and triage of that patient was more painful than another dog, where if it's limping, we might, you know, treat it as a soft tissue injury and see if it doesn't improve. So how do we slow down that process, or how do we combat this bias? Slow down and systematic approaches. That's a common one that affects lots of biases, as you've heard. Also, having algorithms and triage algorithms in your clinic will help your reception and nursing team have something systematic that they can follow, so it's less based on emotion and more based on fact. The last bias we're going to talk about is the belief bias, and this is accepting or rejecting an idea, a response to treatment, a treatment plan, or data based on your own personal belief about how well that test works, how well that intervention works. This is especially true in veterinary medicine because we so often don't obtain a true clinical diagnosis that's confirmed because of limitations, you know, financial from owners. So we often rely on our experience or anecdotal medicine to determine whether or not something worked or whether or not something was a good test. So it's really important to understand that we have these biases, that whether or not we believe in something working will change how we perceive the outcome and the response of that treatment. So, for example, whether or not you believe tramadol works as pain relief will affect how you pain score an animal after giving it tramadol. It's really important to be aware of this bias and be aware of treatment plans or interventions that you have strong opinions on. We really shouldn't have strong opinions on tests or treatments, and if we have a really strong opinion on something, chances are we have a bias either for or against that intervention. You know, things should just be a test. We shouldn't be emotionally charged about a test. So if you're emotionally charged about a test, maybe evaluate whether or not you have a bias against it. To combat this bias, like I said, be aware of your own personal feelings and then try to combat them. Having a systematic approach and algorithms for things that can be subjective. So, for example, pain score charts in your clinic so that everybody is assessing pain on the same basis instead of just their feeling can be really helpful. And also always, always, always trying to pursue evidence-based medicine instead of anecdotal or pattern recognition, because as we've mentioned before, anecdotal and pattern recognition can be so skewed, especially in the vet profession. All right, I know that was a lot, and I thank you for staying with me this far. The second half of this podcast, which will be shorter, is going to talk about how to combat medical biases in general. So there's way more than just 10 medical biases. There's, you know, hundreds of different biases, but I feel like the 10 we chatted about are the most common, and a lot of biases are kind of different versions of the same thing or subsets of other biases. So in general, if we can learn how to eliminate biases or decrease the effect of biases on our medicine in general, even when we come across a bias that isn't one of the ones we chatted about, we can combat it and be better doctors for it. So let's jump into it. The first thing to combat medical biases in general is to learn about them. Just by being aware that these biases exist and actively assessing your own tendency for a particular bias, you're going to be able to actively combat the bias and have better case management and better outcomes. The second point is to slow down. Think twice, cut once. Trying to jump to an answer right away. And in vet med, it's so hard because we have pressure from the clients to get an answer fast and get an answer with the minimum amount of diagnostics and money. We have pressure from the rest of our schedule that day that we need to get an answer because we need to see the next 5 cases. We have pressure from our bosses to know more, and we have pressure from ourselves and this idea that we should know the answer without doing tests. So by understanding that in order to work up a complex medical case or a complex case, you need to slow down and assess everything independently and appropriately is important. Try to not just jump to an answer. Try to slow down and work through the process of each case. The third point is called metacognition and considering alternatives. This is a fancy way to say that you should actively think, what else could this be? It's also a fancy way of saying make a differential diagnosis list. Every single case that comes through your hospital should have a problem list and a differential diagnosis list of other things that it could be. By actively thinking, what else could this be? you're going to decrease your chance of multiple biases affecting your system. And this is actually shown to be the best way to decrease your rate of cognitive errors in medicine and the best way to decrease your rate of misdiagnoses. So every single case, make a problem list, make a differential diagnosis list, and actively consider what else could it be aside from what I'm thinking it is. Number four on combating biases is making checklists. In human medicine, checklists have been shown to statistically decrease the amount of complications and mortality associated with surgeries and decreasing adverse events in anesthesia. Those are the two big areas where checklists are really helpful, but they can be helpful in anything. You know, just a checklist for discharging a patient home. Make sure that they have discharge instructions. Make sure that any pressure bandage is off their foot. If they need a cone, make sure they have a cone. You know, having a checklist for your reception team to double check as any patient is leaving the hospital can be helpful. How many times do people forget to take those pressure bandages off of legs and then come back with complications? The next thing is to assume your first diagnosis is wrong. And this is essentially what we chatted about before, about thinking what else could it be. So if a case is not progressing the way that it should, or they're not getting better, go to the start of that case and reassess all of the information, assuming that your first diagnosis was incorrect. So you're forcing yourself to find a different answer. The next big thing is to round cases properly. And what I mean by that is, instead of saying, this is Fluffy, he's got Addison's disease, he's been treated with this, this, and this, you don't want to put the answer or idea of an answer of what it is, or the idea of a diagnosis, which we like to think of as the answer, in the vet's mind that's coming onto that case. Let them come to their own conclusions. Let them see the data as it came in, so that if something goes weird and if it's not straightforward, instead of you putting your ideas and biases on that new vet coming into the situation, they can come to their own conclusions. So you should say, this is Fluffy. This is a 4-year-old male neutered poodle that presented yesterday for vomiting and collapse. These were the blood results. These were the tests that were done. And go through it that way systematically and in the time frame that they happened, so that you're not putting your biases on the new vet. Another big thing is acknowledging that we can be wrong. Acknowledging that as humans, we are fallible is incredibly important. First of all, it helps take your ego out of the equation, because you're taking away that component of I can do no wrong. And also, it allows you to actively think sooner in the case, oh, could I have messed up with this diagnosis? What else could it be? It helps decrease that barrier to what else could it be, because we can know that we're wrong. It also helps you feel less guilt about performing tests and understanding the value of tests and being more okay with having negative test results. And it also helps to be supportive within the vet field of colleagues, where we can collectively then talk about cases without having, like I said, those egos, that guilt involved, and support each other when we make mistakes instead of it being this shame component. Another big thing that we can do is doing postmortems. This is obviously a challenge in veterinary medicine, because we have that human component of, you know, the clients don't want their little friends cut up is how they think about it. But it is really important in veterinary medicine, because we so often train our pattern recognition incorrectly because we don't get definitive diagnoses in our cases, that it's really quite detrimental. So the more postmortems you can do, the more times you can get a true answer of exactly what went wrong and what the cause was of those clinical signs, you're going to better train your pattern recognition, and you are going to become a better doctor for it. So if you can create a culture within your clinic and with your clientele where you do postmortems, that's really helpful. I know it's a hard one to pursue. The next point is having a place to report errors. when we make mistakes, and we all will, having a global database where mistakes can anonymously be posted and so that statistics and analysis can be done on that collective data so that we can find trends and common mistakes and create solutions that can be implemented globally to decrease the number of mistakes made is really important. And as far as I can tell, we really don't have that in veterinary medicine. It's a future goal of Kick-Ass Vets is to create this database. If someone knows of a place where vets can anonymously report their errors, please let me know so that we can share that around. But it's really important to report errors because that is going to help the progression of the profession as a whole. And the biggest barrier of people doing this is they've got egos. We're afraid to admit that we make mistakes, and we're afraid of punishment. We're afraid of legal action if we admit that we make mistakes. So having a database where, you know, the points of the case can be taken into account so that things can be collected so that we can say, hey, look, in clinics, this mistake is being made over and over and over again. What can we do, and what can clinics do to implement in their clinics so that that mistake isn't made? Maybe it's a wrong dose of a medication is constantly being dispensed because there's two different concentrations. Well, maybe we need to go to the manufacturers and say, hey, let's only make one concentration of that drug because it's constantly causing mistakes and problems in the patients. You know, that's just one example, but lots of things can be done. The last big point that I want to chat about is teaching decision-making and critical thinking in our clinics. So in school, there's so much information. It's such a big data load that students need to take in. It's hard to also teach critical thinking and decision-making processes just by the sheer nature of the fact that, you know, you have all these species, you have all these disciplines, and you need to learn so much actual raw data that anything else on top of that is difficult. As students go out into clinical practice, and everyone that's mentoring students in clinical practice needs to take on the responsibility of teaching decision-making and teaching critical thinking and really allowing students to work through those medical cases using evidence-based medicine, making those problem lists, making those differentials, pursuing as many diagnostics as possible to get to a true answer so that we are teaching and training proper decision making, proper algorithms, proper medicine to get to answers so that we're not pushing our biases and pushing our anecdotal medicine on them. And that will make a huge difference as the generations of vets move through. Part of doing that and part of that decision making and critical thinking process is having systematic approaches and having algorithms that are done with every single case so that things aren't missed. You want to have a process. So, you know, making sure and encouraging complete physical exams, encouraging really detailed records that have problem lists, have differential diagnoses, having algorithms in your clinic so that if new grads aren't sure what to do, they can have somewhere where they can go where they can have an evidence-based medicine approach support, or for your support staff having algorithms for triage or for pain scoring and that sort of thing, so that we can know how to properly assess information, and also having templates in your system. So, you know, for x-rays, for physical exams, making sure that your new grads are using these templates and making sure that they're filling out each line of that physical exam so that they're forced to make sure that they've checked that for every animal so that they are being very thorough in each case and not just jumping to answers, not skipping and missing stuff like the inguinal hernia because they saw the bone on the x-ray. You know, we want to make sure that we're helping the new grads and helping everyone in our clinic to be the best vet they can be. And that means giving them as much support as possible to perform the best possible medicine they can. All right, guys, I know this was a really long one. I really appreciate you sticking with me to the end. And today we've talked about medical biases, how they affect our medicine, and how we can combat them, and just general tips and skills of what we can do to combat biases as a whole. And it's really important to keep all of these in mind when you're practicing, because as we said at the beginning, the data shows that at least 1 in 10 of our patients are negatively affected by our thought process. And if we can just be aware and slow down and have these processes in place, we can drastically improve patient care. And at the end of the day, we're all here because we love animals and we all just want to make them feel better. So get out there. Be aware of these biases. If you see them happening in your clinic and see them happening with your colleagues, make them aware of it. Just say, hey, you know, there's these biases that exist. I think maybe this might be something that might be affecting you. I know this medical biases affect me in this way. And share that information that they exist, because that's really going to help the progression of the profession as a whole. And advocate for yourself, advocate for your staff, advocate for your patients by putting in systems and putting in templates and workflow situations so that you can combat these biases. Thanks again for joining. I really appreciate it, and we will see you next time. Thanks so much.